Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steel. And Lila will be joining us soon, I hope. And tonight we're going to, we have an interesting thing going on. Tonight we have former Federal Justice Oliver Diaz, who was indicted by the Republican Party, basically, under Karl Rove, and by the Department of Justice, yeah. But I like to call it Department of Karl Rove, all right? And but we're going to have an interview with him tonight.
He's a very brave man and well-spoken.
Yeah.
And the terrible things they did at that time, just terrible.
And they indicted and convicted almost 600, over 600 people during the Bush administration. On nothing more than
silly charges, small charges, but they
were. Yeah, it was political prosecution, actually. And there's they have a website called politicalprosecution.org, which goes into what happened. And there's also a remarkable video that we played last week, a part of it on our show. But we talked to Chap Walker last week, but this week we'll be talking to. This week we have an interview with Oliver Diaz, former justice in Mississippi, state of Mississippi. He's now an attorney, but there's an organization trying to, shed light on all of these people, and director John McKiernan, who directed Die Hard and Hunt for Red October and several other great movies. Has found himself in a position found himself in a very unlikely position because he was a major Democratic donor, and he was being investigated by the FBI, but also put on by the Department of Justice, of course.
Yeah, it's sort of a hit list.
Yeah, anybody who was a major Democratic
contributor
was getting hit by the Justice Department and to try to squelch all Democratic donors. Okay,
so in other words, their idea was to target certain areas and sew it up for the Republicans.
Right, and they did that very
for a long time.
They did a great job at that. So, indicted a number of innocent people. And Oliver will be talking about his story tonight, coming up, and in a little while. And we're going to do a little bit of news here, and excuse me a second here, I'm trying to get my information. This is an interesting one. This is kind of interesting, and I'm not sure.
European Union is to hold the Atheist and Freemason Summit.
Yeah. And Brussels is to hold an EU summit with atheists and Freemasons in the autumn, inviting them to a political dialogue parallel to the annual summit to the bloc. With Europe's religious leaders. While the EU is a secular body, the three European presidents of the Commission, Parliament, and EU Council, alongside two commissioners on Monday, met with 24 bishops, chief rabbis, and muftis, as well as leaders from the Hindu and Sikh communities. The annual dialogue, which has taken place since 2005, is for the first time this year made legally obligatory under Article 17 of the Lisbon Treaty. I'm going to go on with that. This sounds interesting. Let's see. Under pressure from Belgium, which constitutionally protects and financially supports humanist organizations as well as churches, the U.S. forced to hold a mirror image summit, but of atheists scheduled for October 15th. However, in a move that perplexed and annoyed humanist groups, the EU Atheist Summit will also welcome under the rubric of non-religious groups the Freemasons, the secretive fraternal organization, according to Commission spokeswoman Katrina von Schnurbein. Yeah. I find it rather odd, David Pollack, president of the European Humanist Federation, told EU observers, some of the Grand Lodges are secularist organizations and strongly for separation of church and state, but they also retain a sort of gobbledygook and myths such as the great architect of the universe. Emerging in the late 16th century in England and subsequently spread throughout the world, the Freemasons split in 1877 between English-speaking lodges and their continental counterparts over the question of God. Anglophone Freemasons require that their members believe in a deity, while continental Freemasons do not. Their public face is that they do charitable work and they do indeed engage in this, but there are also rituals involving blindfolded candidates with their trouser legs rolled up during the initiation. Did you miss the bullet? It's boys' game sort of thing. Yeah, this is not true, because anybody who knows the Masons or knows what the Mason rituals are, and I've been not that I've been inducted, but that I know what they are because I've known Masons who've told me. That is a something that. Interesting article. You can go to euobserver.com and get the rest of that. I'm going to continue and scroll down. This is an interesting one because I think this is critical. I read this last night, but I have a small video here. We'll play the audio portion, of course. But BP oil spill crisis. Methane expert says seawater is flammable. And I'm just going to play that and see what that's all about.
It's like a cloudy sky if you were sitting on the ground. If there are clouds, they're all tending to hover around the same layer, around the same height or the same depth in the ocean. So if you imagine you're trying to sample, you're trying to hit a cloud from above, but you can't see it. You're just flying around and dropping something and trying to hit a cloud. They have all these hallmark features, which include high concentrations of natural gas, reductions of oxygen between 5 and 35% of the ambient level. They also show fluorescence, which is probably indicative of aromatic hydrocarbons, which are components of oil, and there are particles there, which could well be particles of oil, tiny little particles of oil in the water. They tend to hover at depths of something like 3,000 feet and maybe be 100, 200, maybe 300 feet thick. And they extend over a fairly broad area. Some of them we would track for maybe 6-7 miles in one direction. If you took that water in a sampler and brought it up to the surface, you could probably coax it to flame a little bit. That's how much methane is trapped in it. When we took water samples there and we analyzed the natural gases, we see the natural gas content, particularly methane, but also ethane and propane, is elevated by something on the order of 10,000 to 100,000 fold over natural background levels. There's also now indications that at least the first subset of samples have dispersants in them as well. However, what the dispersant is doing to the oil as it migrates, that's a completely open question still. One thing we did see that was interesting, and the Associated Press reported on this, I think, 2 days ago, a lot of dead pyrosomes at the surface. And these are filter feeders that tend to live in deeper waters, 500 to 1,000 meters. Normally, these filter feeders, they're sucking in a whole bunch of water and filtering and eating whatever they catch. And usually when they die, they sink to the bottom. And in the oil slicks around the spill site, there are many of them, certainly hundreds if not thousands, dead at the surface, which is a little unusual. And may be associated with the deeper oil plumes, and so we did see quite a bit of dead pyrosome.
right, this is.
I'm not sure what a pyrosome is. It must be some kind
of. It's an animal that filters water. It's a filtering kind of.
How big it is or what
it
is.
They don't say. But that was from.
Some kind of organism.
Right. That, I just wanted.
You're
to
sitting on the seafloor, looking up. It's like a.
That was from. Golf Impact .org, I think.
Well, you can get any of this on David Icke.
Yeah, but I wanted to. I wanted to. ProjectGolfImpact.com. You can check that out. They have a whole bunch of stuff there. ProjectGolfImpact.com. So there's a bunch of methane gas. This is an interesting one. California officials' $800,000 salary in the city of a 38,000 triggers protests. Hey,
mm-hmm.
You want to read that one? Or?
Sure. Hundreds of residents of one of the poorest municipalities in Los Angeles County shouted in protest last night as tensions rose over the report that the city manager earns an annual salary of almost $800,000. An overflow crowd packed a city council meeting in Bell, a mostly Hispanic city of 38,000, about 10 miles southeast of Los Angeles, to call for the resignation of Mayor Oscar Hernandez and other city officials. Residents left standing outside the chamber banged on the doors and shouted, "Fuera," or "Get out," in Spanish. It was the first council meeting since the Los Angeles Times reported July 15th that the chief administrative officer, Robert Rizzo, earned $787,637 with annual 12% raises, and that Bell pays its police chief $457,000, more than Los Angeles police chief Beck makes in a city of 3.8 million people. Bell council members earn almost $100,000 for part-time work.
I think there's corruption there.
I guess so.
Serious corruption.
City Attorney Edward Lee said the council members couldn't discuss salaries in public without advance notice. The council then adjourned for a private session. About an hour later, the council members returned and Hernandez wrote a statement saying the city would prepare a report on the salaries and seek public comment at the next council meeting scheduled for August 16th. Residents shouted in protest. Lee said he would have the room cleared if people continued to speak out of line. Police Chief Randy Adams said the fire department wanted to end the meeting because the crowd outside was blocking the door. Easing tensions, then in what appeared to be an effort to ease tensions, Hernandez announced that the meeting to discuss salaries would be held on July 26th. After the meeting, Bell resident Ali Sala read a statement from a newly formed group called the Bell Association to Stop the Abuse. He called for an independent audit of city salaries and contracts. On July 1st, Bell took control of many of the city functions of the neighboring Maywood, a city whose council members voted to contract out almost all services. Sala also asked that Bell stop the process until the city salaries investigation were resolved. Bell has sold two general obligation bond issues totaling $50 million in the past years, according to prospectuses for the bonds and information in the city's annual financial statement for 2010. In that time, the debt has risen to $1,972 per capita in 2009 from $599 in 2004, according to annual financial statements.
Imagine what the taxes must be in this place in order to sustain those kind of salaries.
I can't imagine.
Good God. City's personal income was $24,800 per capita. Okay, did you just read that?
No.
According to financial statement, that compares an average of $32,819 nationwide, according to 2010 figures in the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis. Bell's general fund revenue declined 4.6% to $14.1 million for the fiscal year that ended June 30, 2009. For a city financial statement, the city expenses rose 2.3%. I mean, these jerk-offs are getting 12% increases on astronomical salaries.
Yeah.
I mean, in one of the poorest cities in the area. Yeah, it's unbelievable. The article goes quite a bit longer, but if you want to check this one out, please go to Bloomberg. yeah, Bloomberg.
Or David Icke's site.
Yeah, English, but if you want to, if they want to get it directly, go to Bloomberg. That's where I'm quoting it from. All right. So anyway, Sarkozy accused of working for Israeli intelligence.
Yeah.
As if his marital challenges were not enough cause for concern, Sarko the Sayan has.
Suddenly emerges the most infamous accolade of the French president, Nicolas Sarkozy.
The influential French daily Le Figaro last week revealed that the French leader once worked for, and perhaps still does, it hinted, the Israeli intelligence as a Sayan, Hebrew for helper, one of the thousands of Jewish citizens of countries other than Israel who cooperate with the Katzas. Are Mossad case officers.
Nice.
That is it. So he's a Mossad agent. Ah, and he's the head of the French government. It would be interesting. A letter dispatched to French police officials late last winter, long before the presidential election, but somehow kept secret, revealed that Sarkozy was recruited by an Israeli spy, and the French police is currently investigating documents concerning Sarkozy's alleged espionage activities on behalf of the Mossad, which Le Figaro claims dated as far back as 1983. According to the author of the message in 1978, Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin ordered the infiltration of the French ruling Gaullist Party and Union Pour un Mouvement Populaire. Originally targeted were Patrick Balkany. It goes a long, long way. But anyway, there were a number of people. Ex-Mossad agent Victor Ostrovsky described how Sayanim function by way of deception, the making and unmaking of a Mossad officer. They are usually reached through relatives in Israel. An Israeli with a relative in France, for instance, might be asked to draft a letter saying the person bearing the letter represents an organization whose main goal is to help save Jewish people in the diaspora. Could the French relative help in any way? They perform many different roles. A car seyan, for example, running a rental car agency, could help the Mossad rent a car without having to complete the usual documentation. An apartment seyan would find accommodation without raising suspicions, and a bank seyan would fund someone in the middle of the night if need be. And a doctor seyan would treat a bullet wound without reporting it to the police. So he was a seyan.
Hmm.
He was a helper.
So how did he help?
And a political seyan. It's rather obvious what this would mean. The Sayam are a pool of people at the ready who will keep quiet about their actions out of loyalty to the cause, a non-risk recruitment system that draws from the millions of Jewish people outside of Israel. Such talk sends chills down spines, especially Arabs and Muslim ones. Indeed, the revelation did not go unnoticed in Arab capitals or come as much of a surprise. Paris can be a sunny place for shady people. When it comes to intelligence gathering on behalf of Israel, a question mark is immediately raised on the moral caliber of the person in question. But how does this scandal influence France's foreign and domestic politics? It is of symbolic significance that Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was on a state visit to France in the immediate aftermath of Le Figaro expose.
Ostensibly discuss Iran's nuclear agenda and the Palestinian question. Proud and prickly France, under its supposedly savvy new president's hopes to play a more prominent role in the perplexing world of Middle East politics. On Monday, Sarkozy flew to Morocco, the ancestral home of many of France's Jewry, soon after his Mossad connection was made public. There is no clear evidence that the revelation is to make France any more unpopular in the Arab world than it already is, especially not in official circles.
On the domestic front, however, there are many conflicting considerations. The Jews of France now display a touch of the vapors in sharp contrast to the conceited triumphalism with which they greeted his election. We are persuaded that the new president will continue eradicating anti-Israeli resistance. Sammy Gosselin, president of the Jewish community of Paris, pontificated soon after Sarkozy's election. France is home to 500,000 Jews, mostly Sephardic Jews. From North of Africa and Mediterranean countries. Sarkozy's own maternal grandmother, Erin Mulla,
hailed from Salonika, Greece, is said to have exercised considerable influence on his grandson. Even though raised a Roman Catholic, Sarkozy played a critical role in moving the French government to do what is necessary to address the ill winds that threaten the largest Jewish community in Western Europe, noted David Harris, the executive director of the American Jewish Committee. Sarkozy, after all, was a political product of the prominently Jewish elite neighborhood of Neuilly-sur-Seine, where he long served as mayor. France's Muslim minority was far from surprised by Le Figaro's revelations, even though some may have feigned disappointment. Others have been more forthright. France is not run by Frenchmen, but by lackeys of the Zionist International, who control the economy, lamented Radio Islam. Radio Islam of militant Islamist tendencies. When Sarkozy was France's Minister of Interior and clamped down hard on Muslim immigrants, calling mainly Muslim rioters scum in a widely publicized interview. They retaliated by calling him Sarkozy Saljif, dirty Jew. Obviously, there's no love between the 5 million strong French Muslim community, the largest in Western Europe, and the French president. He has grounds for a concern. He assiduously courts the Israelis. That much is known.
Well, they should get rid of him.
Oh, this keeps going.
Yeah, they should get rid of him. But it's kind of long. But I recommend you go to the...
Let's see what the last paragraph says.
Okay. France is now in the awkward position of having no first lady.
Oh, what happened to her?
Did he get divorced?
She must have dumped him.
Interesting twist, though.
In
the interesting twist, though, the real magic starts when you power Sarkozy with his ex-model wife. She, after all, played a part in the freeing of the Bulgarian nurses and her Palestinian medical doctor. She, too, has a Spanish-Jewish ancestry. But that may be nothing but an insignificant aside. France generally regarded their bust-up as something of a bad joke. Unlike the Americans, the French do not take the private lives of their presidents terribly serious. They were the late François Mitterrand, for example. Hardly anyone in all of France raised an eyebrow when it transpired that he had an illegitimate daughter. And the French are more concerned with the ideological orientation and political affiliation of their president and are not in the least interested in their private affairs, at least not in any political sense.
The interesting twist, however, is that the contest between Celia and Nicolas Sarkozy is a comic cross between a lover's tiff and the battle of the sexes. It appears befuddled French voters are being forced to turn a blind eye to their leader's antics. Sarkozy's divorce follows hard on the heels of the separation of France's first female presidential candidate, Ségolène Royal,
and
the gazelle of French politics,
that's good.
From her lifelong lover, François Hollande, barely a month after she lost the presidential race in May. However, at the tender age of 19, Royale sued her father for his refusal to divorce her mother and pay alimony and child support. This was way back in 1972. Barely a decade later, she won the case against her father. Ironically, Royale's own mentor, the late French socialist President Mitterrand, was notorious for his extramarital affairs, the most conspicuous being his love affair with Anne Pinochet,
P-I-N-G-E-O-T,
And the subsequent disclosure towards the end of his life that he fathered an illegitimate daughter, Mazarin, with her. And one of the voters, the latest hard hazard facing the French president, has been his socio-economic policies. Sarkozy's showdown with the trade unions threatens to run into a deciding moment for France. Foreign policy, too, has come under much scrutiny. France has become fanatically
Atlanticist
under the presidency of Sarkozy. Unlike U.S. President George W. Bush, Sarkozy does not make much noise about his own dubious religious convictions. The common criticism of Sarkozy is that he is overly conscious of his religious heritage, a trait that is not appreciated by the fanatically secular French political establishment. France is culturally the most irreligious country in Europe, itself the most secular and anti-religious of the world's continents.
Interesting. For a politician acclaimed for his acumen, it is startling that Sarkozy has been tripped up by events he should have seen coming. His sagacity obviously failed him this week. Le Figaro let the cat out of the bag, and his wife too, after shopping with Ludmila
Putin,
the Russian First Lady, apparently decided that she had had enough of being treated as part of the furniture and made their rift very public. France is now in the awkward position of having no First Lady. The 49-year-old former model, lawyer, and political advisor is by no means media shy. "I gave Nicholas 20 years of my life," she told the popular French magazine Elle in a special feature which she asked for personally, despite the awkwardness of its timing. And she had long complained of being politically peripheralized. Troubling as that interpretation is, it is in a way of consoling one for Sarkozy. He is now free to handle his opponent without the maverick Cecilia breathing down his neck. No, this is not that old.
This is talking about his...
No, this is not old. Oh, it is old.
Yeah, because they're talking about his first wife. He's already been married.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. That's interesting.
So this
okay,
is very
so
old.
This is 2007. That's three. Oh. Well, why didn't they say this in this article? Oh. See, they just published this and they republished it.
I think the key part is that he was accused of being a Mossad
undercover. I didn't know that he got... I didn't hear anything about a breakup with his wife.
That was all about the breakup of his first wife.
Well, we got an interview coming up right now.
Sorry about that, folks. We were a little misled when we were reading that.
Sorry.
It was a long
article.
It wasn't until I realized they were talking about the wife that he had already divorced.
Well, we screw up here on the LA Steel Show once in a while. BP Photoshop's fake photo of Crisis Command Center. Posted on main VP site. Holy cow. Oh, God. Our teenagers are getting digitally high from music they download from the internet. Let's see. They put on their headphones, drape a hood over their head, and drift off into a world of digital highs. A video was posted on YouTube show a young girl freaking out and leaping up in fear, a teenager shaking violently, and a young boy in extreme distress. This is the world of eye dosing. The new craze sweeping the internet in which teenagers used so-called digital drugs to change their brains in the same way as real-life narcotics. But there has been such alarm in the U.S. that the Oklahoma Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs has issued a warning to children not to do it. Kids are going to flock to these sites just to see what it is about, and it can lead them to other places, spokesman Woodward. He added that parental awareness is key to preventing future, since eye dosing could indicate a willingness to experiment with drugs. So they eye dose, internet dosing.
Mm.
Interesting. Okay. One more thing. Greenpeace finds evidence of GM rice contamination in China's emergency grain stores. Taser accidentally discharged a man's groin.
Oh my God.
Jesus. Police were investigating today after an officer accidentally discharged a 50,000-volt taser weapon into a man's groin. Peter Cox, 49, was seeking legal advice over the incident and started when he was stopped on suspicion of driving a BMW without insurance.
This is more important, this next article.
Different faces, same song sheet, Tweedledee, Tweedledum on questioning 911. This is 1 minute, so then we'll go to our interview. This is Obama.
Yeah.
Oops.
Or even justify the offense of 9/11. But let us be clear. Al-Qaeda killed nearly 3,000 people on that day. The victims were innocent men, women, and children from America and many other nations who had done nothing to harm anybody. And yet Al-Qaeda chose to ruthlessly murder these people, claimed credit for the attack, and even now states their determination to kill on a massive scale. They have affiliates in many countries and are trying to expand their reach. These are not opinions to be debated. These are facts to be dealt with. These are not opinions to be debated. These are facts to be dealt with.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th. Malicious lies that attempt to shift the blame away from the terrorists themselves, away from the guilty.
That was George Bush and Tweedledee and Tweedledum. And Obama.
Yeah.
Okay, and if you want to read some more interesting stuff, go to davidicke.com. A fascinating guy, fascinating blog. Okay, so go for that. And we're going to go to our
very own interview.
Our interview with Oliver Diaz, former judge Oliver Diaz, who was wrongfully prosecuted by the by the Bush administration and lost his position, and but was acquitted twice. And he'll tell his story and tell what's going on here. And if you're interested, this is an ongoing thing now, and over 600. Illegally and wrongfully prosecuted people were
targeted by
the Bush administration.
And what it is that they target the people with a plan to sew up permanently their Republican
right.
elections.
So we have a little intro here.
Election of Republican candidates.
Yeah, a little intro and the interview with Oliver Diaz. It's about 30 minutes.
The Department of Justice and Bush and his administration, they targeted moderate Republicans and Democrats to get them out of the way. In this case, they wanted Oliver Diaz out of the way because he had political aspirations, and they wanted to make room for Bush people who were loyal to Bush. This didn't only happen to him, but it happened to several others, too. And the and this is what this says in this article. The Diaz case reflects another astonishing example of highly partisan justice, time presented and calculated to boost the electoral prospects of Haley Barbour.
Right. We have Oliver Diaz on. Hello, Oliver. How are you?
Hey, doing fine. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for coming on. We really appreciate this, and we feel that what you guys are fighting is, I don't know if it's hopeless, but I'm hoping it's not, and I'm hoping that we can at least give some attention to this fight and maybe get into it with you.
Yeah, well, great. I appreciate it. Yeah, this needs to be a story that needs to be told. If these folks really won't believe what happened, and it's happening all across the country, actually. It's happened not only in Mississippi where I am, but it's happened all over.
I can't imagine how stunned you must have been when all this happened. Did it come completely out of the blue, or did you suspect that you were being targeted?
Well, first of all, it was sort of just out of the blue. I learned in 2002 that I was being investigated by the FBI, and I was a sitting Mississippi Supreme Court justice. It just didn't make any sense to me. I had no idea what was going on. Found out that I was being investigated for bribery. It was just amazing. It was just like being blindsided, not expecting it at all.
Now you were a moderate Republican, right? Are you a Republican, or were you a Democrat?
Yeah, well, judges in Mississippi are nonpartisan. We're not allowed to affiliate with any party. I did serve in the Mississippi legislature, and I was elected as a Republican in the Mississippi legislature. I would be what you would probably be called as a moderate Republican. Since that time, I consider myself much more out of touch with the Republican Party and much more in line with the Democratic Party.
Now, they brought charges of bribery against you. How did you deal with that, and what happened? Would you tell our listeners about it?
Yeah, I found out in 2002 that I was being investigated for bribery. I mean, it was just I was completely in shock. I learned that they were investigating my very good friend, Paul Miner, who was actually the largest contributor to the Democratic Party in the state of Mississippi. He was actually one of the largest Democratic Party donors nationwide, but he was by far the largest Democratic donor in the state of Mississippi. And he was a very good friend of mine, and he supported my campaigns. And we learned that I was being investigated. He and I both were being investigated for alleged bribery in connection with his political contributions to my campaign. What caught me off guard so much is that Paul was a very good friend of mine. Paul Miner was his name. He was a very good friend, and because we were such good friends, I had told him that I was not going to vote on any of his cases that ever came before me as a judge at the Mississippi Supreme Court, and I did not. So when we found out that we were being investigated for bribery, I sort of just kind of laughed it off, saying, you know, they're going to quickly look into this and find out that, you know, I've never voted on any of his cases. There couldn't be any possible allegations of bribery.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't stop them. They came forward with bribery charges, and I was indicted for being bribed by Paul Miner, my good friend, who I had never voted on a case that he had pending before me as a judge.
Now, how much of your time did this indictment and trial take?
I'm sorry, how much what?
How much time did this indictment and trial take?
Well, the investigation began in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
We were indicted in August of 2003,
mm-hmm.
Just a few short months before the Mississippi gubernatorial election, where Haley Barbour had decided he was going to come back to Mississippi after leaving the National Republican Party chairmanship and his lobbying firm in Washington, D.C., and decided he was going to run for governor. We were indicted in August of 2003, just before that November election.
Mm-hmm.
Haley Barbour used that indictment in his campaign for governor because, as I said, Paul Miner was one of the largest Democratic donors in the state of Mississippi, and he donated heavily to the Democratic gubernatorial candidate. And Haley Barbour used that indictment as a weapon in his campaign, saying, look, all these Democrats are corrupt and
mm-hmm.
need to elect me as your governor.
So do you believe that this indictment really was really broader than it looked, that you really weren't the target? It was the Democratic Party, the Democratic machine, and to cast aspersions on Democrats and their party at that time?
Yeah, after looking at what happened, during the time, we didn't know what was going on. And like I said, we couldn't figure out why we were even being investigated when I had never even voted on any of Paul Miner's cases. But after looking at what has gone on around the country, we've been able to figure out that there was a systematic effort to target large contributors to the Democratic Party across the United States in order to stop campaign funding for Democratic candidates at all levels.
Mm-hmm.
This was just before the 2004 election when George Bush was running for re-election, and And what we think was happening was that the Republican Party, we don't know how high up it went, probably very high, but they were looking at potential opponents for George W. Bush in the 2004 election and looking to cut off funding for any of the opponents that may run against him. Paul Miner was one of John Edwards' top 10 contributors nationwide, and of course, at that time in 2003, Edwards was seen as a very strong potential opponent for George Bush in the 2004 election.
Mm-hmm. So you were what they like to so fondly call collateral damage.
I guess you could call it that. I brought the headlines to the case for the indictment, the Republican-led indictment against me and Paul Miner. It was certainly sensational locally in the state of Mississippi to have indicted a sitting Supreme Court justice, and they certainly trumped up those headlines every chance that they got.
But you were acquitted on that one, okay? And then they came after you again.
Yeah, well, like I say, we were indicted in 2003. We actually didn't go to trial until 2005. It was early summer of 2005. We went through a 3-month-long trial where I was fully and completely acquitted of everything. The jury told us later in exit surveys that they had reached that decision on me in about 15 minutes. It took them to decide that I was not guilty, having looked at the evidence and seen that I had never voted on a case with Paul Miner. But nonetheless, from 2002 through 2005, we had this investigation and indictment hanging over our heads.
And then they came back and did and hit you again, all right, right after that, correct?
Yeah, well, what was really amazing, that's right. After I was fully acquitted, the Republican-led prosecutor, his name is Dunica Lampton, he had actually run as a Republican for Congress in Mississippi and was defeated, and George Bush appointed him as U.S. attorney. He then, after I was acquitted, unsealed an indictment against me and said that, well, if he was not guilty then of bribery, I'll bet he didn't properly report any of this campaign contributions on his income tax returns, and he unsealed an indictment against me for tax evasion.
Oh, boy.
Which you were acquitted of again.
Yeah, believe it or not, I was acquitted again. We went to trial on that in 2006. It was a shorter trial. It only lasted about a week this time because they actually had less evidence than they had the first time. The jury reached a verdict again in less than a half hour, finding me not guilty of tax evasion either. And so I was fully acquitted. I don't know if you realize it, but folks that are indicted by the federal government, the statistics, it's like winning the lottery or being struck by lightning may be more appropriate. Less than 98%, well, more than 98% ultimately are either pleaded guilty or convicted after you're indicted by the federal government. And I was indicted twice and acquitted two times, so... I had a lot of luck on my side, but not only luck, but I had the facts on my side as well. I had not done anything wrong, so I think that helps a little bit.
Congratulations.
What really bothered me so much about your case was the unbelievable harassment that you received from these guys. And, I mean, they broke into your home, they threatened to take away your children, they did all of these things. And, you know, threatened you and your wife, you know, my God. And there's no recourse to this. I mean, you had no recourse as to get back at them for this. I mean, you're dealing with the FBI.
Well, that unfortunately, that's exactly correct. My wife was indicted along with me for these charges of bribery, as you do in most of these small campaigns. You know, we weren't a large organization. My wife worked on my campaign, helped out, and because she was involved in my campaign, the federal prosecutors decided that they would indict her for bribery as well, although she had never taken, could never have voted on any cases or influenced my decisions on any of my cases, but she was indicted for bribery along with me. But they weren't interested in convicting her. They wanted her for information, I think. They were trying to get information that they could use to further prosecute me. They came to her and said, look, you're both under indictment. You're both looking at, about 90 years in prison and millions of dollars in federal fines. We'll guarantee you that if you cooperate with us, we'll guarantee you won't have to serve any time. You won't have to pay any fines. And, by the way, if you're both convicted, I'm sure you can find somebody good to raise your children while both you and your husband are in prison.
So,
that's the sort of tactics they use to get information. It's amazing. It's Gestapo-like tactics that they were using.
This this particular group that you're involved with, which is politicalprosecutions.org, and, of course, John McKiernan and a number of other people. What are you doing other than, of course, this radio shows and stuff like that? What are you? Do you have any recourse against these people? Do you have anything that we can do to get Rove and Bush and these and his minions to back to the table somehow to prosecute them?
Well, that's one of the beauty of this thing from their point of view. There's not a whole lot that can be done legally. Federal prosecutors are pretty much immune from any sort of lawsuit for any action that they take while they're acting within their role as prosecutors or U.S. attorneys. And so there's not a whole lot that can be done. The main thing we can do is tell this story so that it doesn't happen again. This was not an isolated case. It didn't just happen to me in Mississippi. We began studying this to see what was going on nationwide, and we realized that this was happening all across the country. A few years ago, and it's pretty well documented that these U.S. attorneys were improperly fired for refusing to bring political prosecutions.
Well, that's why Gonzalez resigned. I mean,
exactly,
you know.
Exactly. Yeah. The flip side of that, though, and not many people have realized or even focused on it, is if there were U.S. attorneys out there who were being fired because they refused to bring political prosecutions, that really means that there were other U.S. attorneys out there who were bringing political prosecutions. They were prosecuting people purely for political reasons, and that's what we found when we started looking at this stuff all across the country.
What happened to the...
That's truly frightening. When that happens in the United States of America, people are being prosecuted strictly for political reasons.
What can we do to prevent this, though? I mean, we could not prevent it, but can we get back at them in any way? I mean, is there any way...
What happened to the prosecutors that prosecuted these political cases?
Are they still in power?
Where are they?
Yeah, no, like I say, there's not a whole lot legally that can be done. The only thing we can do is shed some light on this story, make sure that that the Justice Department will reform itself and not ever allow something like this to happen again. That's why we're out there so vocal, trying to tell this story as much as we can. And we have our website, politicalprosecutions.org. You can see these prosecutions going on all over the country. It's really frightening when you look at it. All we can do is tell the story and try not to allow this to happen again. I'm not a victim here. You know, I'm very lucky. I'm very fortunate. I was not convicted. I'm still able to make a living. I'm an attorney now practicing law in Mississippi, and I've decided that I want to help folks all across the country that feel that they are being prosecuted for political reasons, and that's what I've been doing lately.
Good.
And so, I'm one of the fortunate ones who's still able to fight back.
Let me ask you this question. What happened to Danica Lampton and the person that prosecuted you? Where is it a man or a woman? I don't know.
Danica Lampton is a man.
Man, okay.
In Mississippi, he's a... He, He has since resigned his office after the most recent election where President Obama was elected. He resigned shortly thereafter.
Hey, before he got fired, you might have, probably you.
Exactly. I think he probably could see the handwriting on the wall there. But, he left office. But here's an interesting thing. I told you that I was prosecuted twice and fully acquitted twice.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the end of my story. Lampton, because he was so angry that he was not able to convict me in two federal trials.
Hold on one second, folks.
Outside the realm of politics, and that's what we've got to do.
Now, who would have the authority to reform that?
Well, it's got to start at the White House on down. It's the Attorney General. That's where it's got to come from. It's got to come from the higher-ups in the Department of Justice.
Yeah, do you have any faith in this Holder, the Attorney General we get now? He seems like a political puppet, if anybody ever was.
Well, I certainly hope so. I think he's head and shoulders above what we've had for the prior 8 years.
I hope so. And everybody, you know, looked good the first year they came into office, didn't they? You know, except Ashcroft looked like hell. I mean, that was ridiculous. But you know, at least everybody gave him a honeymoon for a year. But this guy doesn't look like he's any great shakes. You know, at all.
Now, has anyone from your group been able to approach Obama to talk at the highest level?
No, not personally. No, nobody that in our group has done that. We did put together this website, politicalprosecutions.org. I highly recommend folks go look at this. One of the folks that has been prosecuted around the country is a guy named John McTiernan, who's a movie director from Hollywood. He actually directed the movies, you probably heard of them, Predator, Die Hard, The Hunt for Red October, The Thomas Crown Affair. He actually was able to put together a video, and it's on the website. It's on the first page, politicalprosecutions.org, from this great director that put together what's going on all across the country. If you watch this video, you'll be amazed at what's going on.
We played part of it last week. I don't know.
The audio part.
Some of the audio. But we also did a... but I urged everybody to go to it last week when we had Chap on, but Chap Walker. But I want to urge everybody to do the same this week. Go to politicalprosecutions.org. There was prosecutions rather. There was also a Justice Integrity Project you're involved with, that is. Justiceintegrityproject.org, I believe.
I'm not positive about that one.
Okay.
I have been to that website, but I can't remember.
But it's part of that part of this as well. But do you have any? What kind of faith do you have in this system right now? After you've gone through this, I mean, what kind of faith do you have in the judicial system?
Well, you know, it's strange. A lot of people asked me how I got through the ordeal that I had been involved with, and you know, it's sort of different. I was a judge. I was actually a sitting judge. I devoted my life to the judicial system, this process, and I had no choice but to place my faith in our justice system, that the right outcome would come about, and in my case, it did. In many cases, it didn't. We actually have, believe it or not, we have people sitting in United States federal penitentiaries right now who were prosecuted for nothing other than being involved in politics on the wrong side of a political campaign, and mainly Democrats that were prosecuted by Republican prosecutors. We have people sitting in prison today in the United States. It's really amazing that that's going on.
Well, you know,
that's shocking, really.
Yeah, I believe that Martha Stewart was targeted as well. I mean, she was a heavy campaign donor to the Democratic Party.
She was, yes, she
very,
was.
Very, very heavy, yeah. And don't you know, hello, you know, then she wound up serving 6 months or something. It was like, you know, just unbelievable stuff that I guess, like you said, if they come after you, the odds are that they'll find something. Okay, they'll turn it around and find something. Even if you're innocent, they'll have you pleading guilty just out of fear. You know?
Oh, absolutely. When you're faced with 90 years in prison, and they'll offer you a deal to plead guilty and maybe get 6 months or a year, you know, you do the balancing test on that, and are you willing to roll the dice?
I've seen it from even from the state levels for sure. I mean, the bribery, the deceit, the crookedness in the politicians there, and even on the, like the, you know, different departments. You see it. I've been up against it. I've fought against them, and seen the corruption there. You know, and what a little bit of political persuasion can do. I empathize with you.
I'm amazed at your courage.
I am. I'm proud of you for standing up to these guys, and I wish there was some way that we could get back at them, that there's some way that you could, you know, put this guy into an 8x10 cell, you know, Mr. Rove, if you're listening, you know.
Or any of these other
guy that happily retired with a state pension, you know.
The one thing that these folks hate is the light of day shining on the deeds that they have done.
Oh, really?
And if we can just keep that spotlight focused and tell these stories about what has happened and what they've done, these folks, they really are frightened by the publicity. They don't want to ever have to answer for what they did because they know that there's no way to defend what they did.
Yeah, but the press is such a joke in this country. They didn't do anything in regards to this, did they? They didn't
shine the light on your story.
No, they did not do that.
You're right, they didn't, and that's why we've had to do it ourselves.
I mean, these media whores that they call professional journalists. I mean, they, it's horrible. I mean, it's horrible what we have to put up with in the mainstream to see this and to see people like you, Silver, and 600 or 700 other people that went through this process and absolutely no press coverage, or national coverage, and Karl Rove and George Bush. Walk hand in hand through the tulips. You know what I mean? And leave office and with no indictments. You know, the only guy who got the shaft on that one was Scooter Libby. You know?
Yeah, and he got pardoned.
You know what I mean? But you know what cracked me up though? He didn't get a full pardon. He just got commuted.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so it's like George Bush gave him the shaft after all.
He got the short straw, and then he didn't really get what was agreed to, I'm sure.
Yeah. Hey, did you know that Dick Cheney does not have a pulse? Yeah, I heard that the other night on the news. Dick Cheney does not have a heart.
They put a pump in his heart as something happened to it.
He doesn't have a heart. It's just like a battery.
I'd always thought that he was responsible for all these this rash of vampire movies that we've had.
I think you might be right.
Wouldn't doubt it.
Well, I really admire your resilience. It seems like you've been able to bounce back, and you've been able to continue with your life. Maybe not as a judge, but you found a new mission to help people that are being politically persecuted, and I think that's great that you're doing that because we need people like you to help people. Who can't help themselves. You were part of the system and understood it, but not everybody who's targeted has that inside knowledge.
I mean, the thought that you could, that anybody who could give, any person who can give money to a Democrat or an independent or a Republican or whatever, it could be targeted for that. It's just
outrageous.
Yeah, and almost not even understandable in what we call it, this democracy,
Makes you question a lot.
Oh, well, before we go, what's your opinion of the latest Supreme Court turnaround that corporations now are people and can donate unlimited funds to campaigns?
Yeah, I think that's going to lead to lots of problems in our electoral process from here on out. Folks cannot keep up. Individuals cannot contribute the amounts that these large corporations are able to donate. They're simply going to start buying elections is what I'm afraid of.
Oh, yeah. And then we'll see corporations prosecuting, individuals, you know. It's unbelievable.
Yep.
Well, we want to thank you very much for being on our show, and we hope that this interview shines some light on what's happened, and I hope you continue to speak out on it and help people yourself who are having the same kinds of issues.
Well, thank you for allowing me to be here. I really appreciate what y'all are doing and helping to tell this story, and keep up the good work on your end.
Well, we will, and we'll urge our listeners again to go to politicalprosecutions.org.
All right. Thanks so much, John. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right.
Good night.
Oliver.
That was Oliver Diaz talking to us about what happened to him when he was targeted by the Department of Justice unfairly. Political motives. And Leo, it's top of the hour, station ID.
All right. And that's that. We want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. Join me tomorrow night when we delve into the fourth dimension. And hope you enjoyed the show. Tell your friends. And good night.